Archaeology and paleontology. Friends, enemies, frenemies. We welcome to our underground history segment Nick Famoso, who is the chief paleontologist at the John Day Fossil Beds National Monument in Eastern Oregon, and Chelsea Rose at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Today we'll talk about the differences and similarities between the two sciences. Welcome to the exchange.
Great to be here.
That's good. And do we have Nick on the line here? Let me see if I got Nick. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Everybody's here. That's good. I'm going to start off with a fun question. Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park. Are they good for your careers? Did they inspire you? Do they inspire other people? Any thoughts on how these big blockbuster movies, which are all scientific nonsense, right? Well, maybe not total nonsense, but close to it. Were you guys inspired by these when you were younger?
So this is Chelsea, the archaeologist here, speaking for Indiana Jones. I was certainly inspired by that film series, but you know, now most archaeologists kind of cringe at that portrayal of our discipline. It maybe reflects an early version of it, but certainly not what we do today. I always tell people that the fictional character that actually better represents what we do is Sherlock Holmes, because we look at all the different little tiny clues and minutiae to piece together and tell a bigger story.
Well, that's interesting. And how about you, Nick?
So, interestingly, the Indiana Jones character is partially based on a man by the name of Roy Chapman Andrews, who was also a very avid paleontologist doing a lot of work out in Mongolia. So I like to think a little bit of like, oh yeah, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, paleontologist hanging out with the archaeologist, of course, right? That's how it always is in our lives, right? But, you know, that didn't really inspire me all that much to do paleontology. And Jurassic Park is a very great way of talking about more the genetic side of the world and that science fiction realm. And a lot of what they show there is not at all what paleontology is actually like. You don't find nice complete skeletons like that a helicopter will just blow the dust off of. But for me personally, what I was more inspired with to get interested in the study of past life was The Land Before Time. So I'm an older kid in that kind of respect.
So if you're out, let's say, Chelsea, you're out on a dig somewhere and you're doing your archaeology thing, and all of a sudden you hit bones and you realize it's probably not your neighbor, hopefully, and you look at the bones, do you say, okay, I'm done here, I'm calling Nick, I'm heading back to the office? Is that what happens, or is it more complex than that?
Well, we find animal bones all the time. If we found bones that seem to be fossilized or ancient animal bones, then yeah, that would definitely be the first clue that I was well out of my element there. And then maybe somebody else with a different specialty should come in. And people always, always confuse archaeologists as excavating dinosaurs. I don't know, is the opposite true, Nick? Do you guys get, do people think you excavate arrowheads or something?
Yes. All the time. And I don't even study fossil dinosaurs, so I get a lot of people asking me about dinosaurs. I study fossil mammals, so yes. I get a lot of that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever found a T-Rex? You know, yeah, I bet.
Right, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Nick, about where you're at, the John Day Fossil Beds National Monument out in Eastern Oregon. And what's something, it's probably several things, but what's something that's really special about that area?
Oh, man. I think probably the main reason why this park was established as a national monument and put into the National Park Service is just because of the extensive geologic and paleontological history that is preserved here. And I mean, it's not just what's within the boundaries of the National Monument. It's also like a huge swath of Eastern and Central Oregon that are kind of included in that bit. But I mean, we're covering from like our oldest rocks, fossil-bearing rocks in the park are about 55 million years old, or 50, and the youngest is about 7. And that's the only place, at least in the United States and maybe the world, that has like that much continuous record of time all preserved in one place. And that's part of the reason why, at least from my perspective as a paleontologist, why this place is wonderful and amazing. I mean, we've also got, you know, beautiful views and lots of other really important resources that we protect here. But for me, it's that span of time.
Chelsea?
And I think it's been really interesting to read about some of the archaeology you've been doing in your collections to kind of reevaluate and kind of take a peek at what earlier paleontologists have thought about and how new discoveries are being made with advanced technology. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So, I think the most recent thing that we're talking about here is that jaw that we had published a little earlier this year, the hyena pig. That animal, that was a specimen that was in the collections at the University of Oregon. And it was really interesting with that just because that specimen, that fossil had been so busted up and not super great to look at. And so using advanced technologies can really help us to understand, you know, what exactly was in there because it was too fragile to prepare otherwise. And that's something that, you know, paleontologists have been trying to do for the last, oh gosh, I don't know, like since the 90s, I think, has really been when people started doing that. And it really started with justifying whether or not fossils were fakes or not. So things that would come from other parts of the country or other parts of the world, it's like, well, let's make sure that it's not full of plaster. And then they'd scan it and say, yes, it's rock, or no, actually, there's big chunks of plaster in there. So it actually leads to a lot of really interesting things. And I have a colleague of mine that's going to be starting at UC Berkeley here in a little bit, who actually makes models of fossil animal skulls and looks at what kind of stresses the skull could actually maintain and handle. So, I mean, there's lots of really cool things that technology can do for paleontology.
And before you move on, hyena pig. Okay, can we stop and, like, unpack that a little bit? What on earth is that?
Sure. So the hyena pig, it's a group of animals, and it's an extinct group that's known as a mesonychid. And mesonychids are a group of ungulates, so they're hooved animals that lived a pretty long time ago. We're talking like, you know, in the 40s of millions of years ago here. And they're just, you know, this robust, almost pig-looking thing, but had teeth that were more well-adapted for bone crunching. So they're these critters that were more acting more like a hyena does in the modern ecosystem than a lot of other animals that we think of now. But it was built more like a pig.
Yes, I'm looking at the landing page. Is this a picture of the hyena pig right here on the front?
Which landing page?
For the John Day Fossil Beds
No, actually. So that one is an entelodont. So that's got a couple of different colloquial names that we'll use, the Terminator pig or the Hell pig. And that critter is entirely different. So that was a more recent thing. It's more like pigs than our hyena pig, the mesonychids are. But that was another big one, and they get bigger than the one that's in that picture there. I mean, the biggest ones were like, I don't know, probably like 6, 7, 8 feet at the shoulder.
Mm.
They were massive animals, and they were most likely omnivores. Their teeth tell us that they were eating pretty much whatever they wanted, kind of like a bear does today.
Just looking at the drawing of him, he seemed like an animal with a bad attitude.
I think we need another Land Before Time, the Oregon edition, with the hell pig and the hyena pig as best friends.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Like, people get all excited about dinosaurs, but, I mean, there's such a rich, interesting history about fossil mammals that we can find in pretty much all over this country and all over North America and the world. And oftentimes people, you know, kind of overlook them because, like, oh, it's just a mammal. But, you know, mammals can be pretty cool, too.
And I've been working up in that neck of the woods recently a lot and been by the museum there. And one thing I have to ask you about, the ancient Easter Bunny fossil.
Yeah.
I was like, did the grad student name that or what? Like, what is the ancient Easter Bunny?
Right. So I'm pretty sure that our curatorial staff here at the park back when we opened the building in the early 2000s was got a pretty good chuckle about that one. But, you know, so we have a fossil rabbit record that goes back a really long time, and that particular fossil is from between 31 and, I believe, 26 million years ago. So, I mean, that's some of the early rabbits we find, you know, here, and we've got that record. And so that's, you know, it's just kind of a nod to, like, yes, it's a rabbit, and, you know, it's a very old rabbit. So, yeah.
But not found in association with eggs.
No. No, we actually we have found fossilized eggs in the park, but not in the same rock layer where we found that particular rabbit.
I haven't bought, you know, these T-shirts that say something in many, many years. But I tell you, if there was a T-shirt that had a picture of a help egg, and it's and it said underneath it "help egg," I might wear that. Yeah, yeah. I like that. That's a great name.
I think there might be something like that. I've seen some around for like commercial sales, so you might be able to find something like that.
Have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah.
You mentioned, I was interesting that you mentioned this time frame of from about 55 million years ago to 7 million years ago. Were there multiple events? I mean, we always hear about like the extinction of dinosaurs. Were these sort of gradual or sudden events? It seems like if it covers that big a time frame, maybe there was multiple things going on.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many things going on during that period of time. There's a lot of things going on with global climate during those periods of time. So we've got this event called the Eocene, Oligocene, thermoclimatic optimum, which is like that was when it was really, really warm all across the globe. And so the organisms are really different. So from those rock layers, you've got like, it looks like the Panamanian jungle down there. You've got crocodiles out here in Oregon. You've got all kinds of bizarre things that you normally wouldn't think of as an Oregonian thing. A lot of the stuff that you find is Asian immigrant taxa, actually, the groups of animals. There's a mid-Miocene climactic optimum, which is another like point where things are really great. It's actually, quote-unquote, the heyday of horses, if you will. There's just really abundant amount of horse diversity at that point. And those animals are there, and they start to look like horses. And then temperatures start to cool. And as part of that, what you actually see is spreading of grasslands. And then you get grasslands just ubiquitously all over the continent, you know. So that's another thing that's captured in there. You know, there's just a lot of different transitions that happen. So we have seven different groupings of animals that we talk about here at the park, and each community is different. And that's all because there's some sort of shift in the climate. Like if you went out to Painted Hills unit of the fossil beds. The fossils that you see there are the first time that you see temperate forests in North America. And so it's just like these big transitions and fossil soils being preserved. There's all kinds of different things going on during that time. And little extinctions, but not a mass extinction like what we would see at the end of the age of the ice ages or at the end of the age of dinosaurs.
And I know you've got archaeologists working in and around there. Is there any evidence? I think you said the fossils were as young as 7,000 years. Is there any evidence of overlap with, early people to the region and some of these extinct animals?
Right. So the youngest assemblage we talk about is that 7 million year old rattlesnake formation. But we do have some Pleistocene things that are a little younger. That we'll find in like the river beds and whatnot. We don't have any direct interaction that way, but it is possible. And I've talked to our archaeologists about this, and they haven't found anything specifically in the park. But there is a possibility that some of those fossils would have been used by the native peoples who were in this area. We don't know because we don't have the evidence of it yet. But you know, the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence. So it's totally possible that something like that would have happened here. Usage of those fossils
many years later. Yeah.
I know you have both very different jobs. What would be a typical day for an archaeologist or a paleontologist? Not the day that you're back in the office pushing paperwork, but one of your more exciting days. What would that be, Nick?
So for me, like you said, there's a lot of paperwork. I do work for the federal government. There's a lot of things I have to do as part of the management team here. But I get to do research sometimes, so it'll be like going into collections and measuring things, taking photographs of stuff, helping researchers, in the collections themselves, doing field work. So about in the summer times, once a week, I'll go out into the field and I will do what's called prospecting, which is just kind of like walking around the rock faces looking for fossils that are on the surface, picking them up. And then if there's something big, that's when we start digging them out and try and get them out in those nice, what we call plaster jackets. But oftentimes, you know, it's, you know, probably the more exciting things is when I'm getting to play with data, really, when I'm doing research. And I'm a statistics monkey, so I really like to, you know, do analysis on my computer, and I get really excited about statistics and that kind of thing. But the other thing I get really excited about is doing education and outreach. So as my colleagues here at the park can tell you, I just got really excited because we were able to buy a modern sheep skull that we're going to use at one of our events next week to kind of like show people what a sheep's skull looks like. And I have been insanely excited about it. So even modern stuff that I get to work with as part of those outreach events is another thing that I think is really cool. I like sharing, so that's always a fun thing.
Very good. Chelsea, how about you?
Yeah, I think a lot of the basic principles are similar. We both go out and survey and look for sites or materials, and then excavation probably has some overlap. For us, an archaeological an archaeologist's work is varied. So we do research in the archives. We go out and we dig. And we sometimes just walk around and look for sites. So, you know, I think some of it's similar, but we probably have a much higher chance of finding stuff, I would imagine, huh? Because my data doesn't go back millions of years. It's just the stuff I'm mainly focusing on is just in the last couple hundred years.
Right. Nick, I'm going to put you on hold just temporarily to take a call here. And let's see if we have Mark in Grants Pass. Are you there, Mark?
I am. Thank you, and good morning. Hi, Chelsea. I was on your Jump Off Joe dig 2011 in the summer. I was wondering if I'm looking at some of the stuff that's going on as far as Indigenous Studies curriculum being implemented coming this January, and I'm reading about the Cow Creek folks working with the Umpqua School District. I'm wondering if Sula has got any interface with local school districts about the Indigenous folks that were here?
I don't know specifically about those efforts. So we do a lot of public outreach about all sorts of aspects of local heritage and history regularly and as much as we can, but I don't know specifically about that project.
Okay, thank you, Mark, and we will hopefully bring Nick back here. As you go about your day-to-day work, you talked about being a very interested a statistics monkey. Was that the term you used?
Yes, that is what I used.
Okay,
yes.
It's good to know who you are. Is this like, with this computer age, I never thought about this. On one hand, you're digging millions of years into the past, and yet you're using modern tools. How important has that become in order to, I don't know, cross-reference and check data and all of that other stuff?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, you know, I mean, people were doing this kind of work for a long time, and I don't want to diminutize the work that people did, you know, before the computer age and even before, you know, in the 1800s especially. You know, they were doing a lot of really interesting work, and it was really hard to see other people's specimens. And if you shipped a fossil, sometimes, as our one of our first state geologists, Thomas Condon, would have known, it's hard to sometimes get those things back when you ship them to the expert over on the East Coast. But you know, nowadays it's really easy. I've been able to email or call collections managers at the Yale Museum or at Harvard University Museum and say, hey, can we get photographs of this specimen? And then they'll send us that, and then we can measure that on the computer, as long as we have a scale in the image. You know, so that kind of thing just makes research like more accessible too, because we don't have to spend thousands of dollars to fly all the way there for one specimen. You know, and so I mean, not just that, but just in general, like access to research papers is a lot easier now than it used to be, and knowing what the community is doing, like there's academic versions of social media that are out there that really help to spread the knowledge and papers and things. And so I feel like it's It opens us up to a lot more opportunities now than were in existence before.
Let's talk a little bit about folks who might want to visit the John Day Fossil Beds and have never been there. You grew up in Grants Pass, so you're in our area here. Yep. How long does it take to get out there? And if somebody's going to go, I would assume that it would be better if they could plan for more than one day. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, for me to go back to Grants Pass from the main building here, the headquarters, which is in the Sheeprock unit of the park, it takes me about six and a half hours to get to Grants Pass from here, assuming it's not snowing.
Right.
And, of course, everything's longer. But then once you're here, so we've got three different units. We've got the headquarters, which is the Sheeprock unit, which is an hour away from the Painted Hills unit, which a lot of people know because of the beautiful Painted Hills there. And that's only about, you know, 2 hours, I think, away from Bend. But then, you know, we've got a third unit up in the north, and that's the Clarno unit, and that's about an hour and 45 minutes, two-hour drive from the headquarters unit. And that's north, and Painted Hills is west of here. So, like, if you wanted to see all three units and actually get everything in, it's going to be at least one full day, if not longer. And if you look at it on a map, it doesn't look that far away, but boy, are the roads curvy here, I will tell you.
All right.
Yeah, and we've talked about... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and there's not a lot of gas.
Yeah,
so you have
true.
To be really conscious about gas while you're here.
We've talked before with folks about the mammoth and mastodons that have been found around here. Were you looking for paleontological finds when you were growing up in Grants Pass?
You know, I didn't really look a lot for paleontological finds in that area. It actually turns out Oregon Caves National Monument has some fossils in it, and I learned about that once I went to college. And I was like, oh, man, why didn't I know about that? That's really cool. So I didn't really know a whole lot, and I wasn't really looking a whole lot in Oregon, in Southern Oregon specifically, though there are some really cool, like, fossil shells from the ancient oceans that used to be in the area. But I would come out here. I go up to the town of Fossil. There are some digs kind of in the Willamette Valley, but most of the time I would go out to the other side of the Rocky Mountains to look at things for California.
I'd like to thank my guests who have been with us today. We had, first of all, Nick Famoso, who's the chief paleontologist at the John Day Fossil Beds National Monument over in Eastern Oregon, and Chelsea Rose at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Friends, enemies, frenemies, your frenemies?
Friends!
Friends,
okay. Always friends.
Always friends. Well, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.